Today on Off Mic, the numbers continue to look ugly in the battle against COVID-19 across the country and in Northwest Indiana. We talked to a local expert on the latest numbers and the challenges facing us. And we'll hear a report on worker complaints on COVID-19 to OSHA, such as employers forcing workers to work even if they are sick. And the Grammy nominations came out recently with some noticeable snubs. Who gets to vote and what is the process like? We talked to one voting member of the Grammy Awards. He's actually a very familiar voice. All this on Off Mic. Welcome to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente, reporter with WBEZ in Chicago. Because this is Pledge Week, I'm asking all my listeners to consider giving a little bit to Lakeshore Public Radio, which is making this show possible. Well, we're more than a week past from last week's Thanksgiving holiday, but we're not done with Thanksgiving just yet. Indiana health officials are waiting for COVID numbers to spike in the coming days as many Americans and Hoosiers gathered for family dinner, even though many officials said don't do it in large numbers. In the last 24 hours, Indiana has reported more than 8,500 new COVID cases and 60 deaths. Hospitals are filling up along with ICU units. Joining us to talk about the latest numbers is Micah Pollack, professor of economics at Indiana University Northwest in Gary. Professor, before we get into everything, please tell me how an economics professor has been the go-to expert to follow the numbers on COVID in Northwest Indiana.
Part of my job is crunching numbers, and so I'm good at that. But when the pandemic began, you know, I'm sitting at home, my classes are canceled, I can't help out in hospitals. And so I was looking for a way to help out and a way to kind of empower myself a little bit. And being able to, you know, crunch the numbers and track the trends daily gives me a little bit more confidence about how the world's going. And hopefully I can contribute some to, you know, reducing the uncertainty for other people as well.
You know, that's great, because I tell you, you have been a godsend, because we need more experts like you in Northwest Indiana, because you become a treasure, I think, for a lot of Chicago media outlets.
Oh, well, thank you for that. Yeah, I just started doing it, and then, you know, people were interested, and so I just kind of kept doing it.
All right. Okay, well, let's talk about some of your latest tweets regarding hospitalizations per 1 million people. Indiana was up there just second yesterday. Today they're at third. That's got to be concerning for you.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately what we ultimately care about with COVID is the deaths. And, you know, hospitalizations are kind of the step before the deaths happen. And so if we watch hospitalizations and if our hospitals can keep up with the incoming cases, we don't have to worry as much about as many deaths. But when hospitalizations are reaching the levels we're seeing now, and hospitals are getting overloaded, overwhelmed, maybe they can't provide as much care or as good quality care simply because they have so many patients, that's when things get concerning, because then those cases that could have been, you know, led to recovery ultimately maybe have worse outcomes as a result.
Right, right. And just when you look at some of the numbers, some people might say, well, 514 doesn't seem like a lot, but you say that is actually significant.
Yeah, so, you know, it is tricky when you do per capita, because Indiana has a lot of people, and we don't usually have that many in ICU rooms. So if you look at, you know, 500 per million, you say that's not a very big number, but it's way more than our system is set up to deal with. Even during the first wave, at the peak, it was less than half of that. So if you remember back in the first wave, the whole flatten the curve and don't let hospitals get overwhelmed, well, we've just kind of blown through that level, and we're at double the rate of hospitalization that we had in the first wave.
Doctor, do you think the governor is going to have another press conference this afternoon, but sometimes they seem to try to put a positive spin of everything that's going on. Are there things they're just not saying, or not at least, you know, emphasizing enough to the public? It feels like they're trying to get the message out that, you know, things are getting better.
Yeah, I think one of the key places maybe for this confusion is ICU availability numbers. So if you look on the ISTH's website, they list 20% of ICU beds available in Northwest Indiana, which sounds great, right? I mean, we've got 20% capacity available, but that's just the physical beds and the physical rooms, right? We don't necessarily have the doctors and the nurses and the technicians to serve a patient and care for a patient effectively in that space. You know, we can always add more rooms, but adding more doctors and nurses is not something you can do quickly.
And is that okay? Like, yeah, if you look at the website, State Health Department, it says total capacity is 2,186. But I guess that has been expanded from, it's probably not even, that's probably artificially inflated.
Yeah, prior to the pandemic, I think we were sitting at just over 1,000 ICU beds in the state. So we've definitely put a lot of, you know, surge capacity out there, which again is great, but you know, you can't increase the doctors and the nurses at the same rate as you can, you know, add more physical rooms and beds. I mean, just to give you a more local example here, I was talking with the contact at Franciscan Hospitals today, and they have across all 12 of their hospitals, 11 of which are in Indiana, one is in Illinois, about 20 beds open that are not currently occupied by somebody. So that's not a lot of wiggle room if people get in car accidents. If, you know, your COVID case turns more severe, you know, 20 beds can fill up in all of Northwest Indiana very, very quickly.
Like you said, the staff isn't there to, it's being pulled even thinner by expanding these ICU units, but not increasing staff.
Yeah, and you have to keep in mind that they've been, you know, actively fighting COVID for 9 months now. They're, you know, overworked, overstressed. Many of them are getting sick with COVID, and so, you know, to ask them to keep on dealing with, you know, the rising hospitalizations under those circumstances is not good for the healthcare workers or for, you know, the general public.
What are you looking for in the next 2 weeks? I mean, we just got up out of Thanksgiving. We do know people were flying, and not as much, but a significant amount. People were perhaps not following strictly to the guidelines of not having big family gatherings for Thanksgiving. Where are you paying attention to when that bubble could burst, when you start to see these numbers go up in the next, 2 weeks maybe?
Yeah, if you look back at Labor Day, there's a very clear pattern where 2 weeks after Labor Day, that was the beginning of the current rise. You know, the huge rise that kind of dwarfed everything before was exactly 2 weeks after Labor Day. So I think, you know, we need to be careful in the coming weeks, you know, a couple of weeks after Thanksgiving, especially going into Christmas, to keep an eye on cases. And I think the next 6 weeks or so are probably going to be the most challenging that we've experienced the entire pandemic.
And that was Professor Mika Pollack, Professor of Economics at Indiana University Northwest in Gary. And we'll be back with more Off Mic. Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. Since the first days of the pandemic, one group has consistently been alerting the federal government to COVID-19 concerns, workers in the Chicago and Northwest Indiana area. Workers have filed more than 1,000 complaints from factories to hospitals, but also restaurants and stores. Earlier this month, I joined with Linda Lutton, my colleague at WBEZ, to report on some of the worker complaints filed in Chicago and here in Lake County. Here's that report.
Wendy Gonzalez doesn't know if her coworker at the McDonald's in Bronzeville had COVID, but he was definitely sick.
He will be in the corner complaining that he was feeling nauseous, that his stomach was hurting.
He came to work sick for days. A manager had also disappeared. Gonzalez wondered if that was due to COVID.
That's when I started thinking, something is going on. They're just leaving us in the dark. They're not telling us information about who is getting sick. People is getting sick, they're not going to the doctor, they're going to work, so everybody's exposed. Workers and the customers.
Meanwhile, at the McDonald's at 57th and Kedzie, employees say there were 6 active COVID cases at once last month. Worker Kenya Campiano was one of them. Her entire family got sick.
My husband, mi esposo, yo, mi hermano, un bebé de 5 meses.
And Campiano knows 3 McDonald's employees who've died since the pandemic started. This month, Campiano and Gonzalez both filed complaints with the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA. They're among more than 1,000 Chicago-area OSHA complaints logged by workers from every sector of the economy. Collectively, the complaints represent an outcry from essential workers here. They describe unsanitized stores and restaurants, managers who don't wear masks, COVID-positive employees at work. There was a tsunami of complaints last spring, and they are still rolling in. Eric Fruman is with Change to Win, a coalition of unions.
These complaints are a really important warning to Chicagoland and to the nation that these conditions exist, that workers are scared, and that someone ought to be forcing these companies, whether it's the media or OSHA or the governor or the attorney general or somebody, to get up, smell the coffee, protect workers, and stop this epidemic.
Fruman and other labor advocates are outraged that OSHA has done so few on-site inspections during the pandemic, instead investigating complaints by talking with employers via fax or phone. In the Chicago area, out of more than 1,000 closed complaints, OSHA did just 6 site inspections.
Complaints are essentially being ignored.
Peg Seminario worked for 30 years on workplace safety issues with the AFL-CIO.
This isn't just about what's going on in workplaces. I mean, this virus, what happens in the workplace is brought home to communities.
Employers say they care about that. Take McDonald's. The company says it's worked with contagious disease experts and issued national guidelines to keep workers and customers safe. In Chicago, McDonald's attracted more OSHA complaints than any other employer. But the company says worker allegations are inaccurate and part of a union PR campaign. Gonzalez, the McDonald's worker who put her name to one of those complaints, says she was standing up for herself and her coworkers.
Somebody has to start, and I'm glad that I did. I don't feel ashamed because I don't want to die because of McDonald's. So I had to do something because I love my family. I love myself. And I didn't work at McDonald's to get sick or die there.
I'm Linda Lutton.
And I'm Michael Puente. I'm across the state line from Chicago in Lake County, Indiana, an area that accounts for 20% of all OSHA complaints filed by employees in the region. This blue-collar area is home to scores of essential workers in manufacturing, retail, transportation, and food services. 20-year-old Iris Ramirez worked as a waitress at Round the Clock, a popular 24-hour restaurant in Highland, Indiana.
I wanted to get tested because I started developing symptoms, but my manager, he told me, oh, it's probably nothing, just come into work.
Ramirez was working long hours.
I had the most hours than any other waitress. I was doing around 70 to 73 hours a week.
She says her manager wanted her to come in even as she awaited her test results.
He didn't force me, but he definitely was telling me just to, you know, make light of the symptoms before I got the results.
She tested positive. She hasn't been back since. A complaint was filed against Round the Clock. Ramirez says it wasn't her. It alleges the restaurant isn't being cleaned properly and bosses pressure employees to come to work even if they might have COVID.
We would never do that.
Owner Elias Litos denies all allegations. He says he provided documentation to OSHA to show he's in compliance with all COVID safety guidelines. Still, he says some complaints against other employers may have merit.
There's businesses doing, you know, things they're not supposed to be doing. I think they should be exposed. I think if there are individuals that are doing things they're not supposed to be doing, they should be exposed. But you got to kind of make sure that you're getting the right information and going from there. I think that's kind of got to be how you got to move forward.
Across the metro area, manufacturing has attracted more complaints than any other industry. For example, at the Lear Corporation, which makes automobile seats at a plant in Hammond, workers have filed 7 complaints since the pandemic began. The company declined comment on any of those complaints. UIC occupational health expert Linda Forrest says it doesn't have to be that way. Workplaces can be made safe.
Then people can go to work and they're not going to get sick there.
Forrest says social distancing, masks, and paid sick leave can make a difference.
If those measures aren't taken, you know, then everything has to shut down, and that's a shame for everybody.
Forrest says the OSHA complaints are important because workers are on the ground seeing exactly what is happening or not happening in the workplace. And that was the report brought to you by me, Michael Puente, and my colleague at WBEZ, Linda Ludden. And we'll be back with more Off Mic. Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. Baby boxes. We're not talking about small boxes, but boxes where young mothers can place their newborn child if they feel they cannot care for that child. Earlier this week, the 14th baby box in Northwest Indiana was dedicated. It's at the Gary, Indiana Fire Department at 4959 Pennsylvania Street. Joining us to talk about the history and efforts of this initiative is Monica Kelsey, who heads Safe Haven Baby Boxes out of Woodburn, Indiana. So, Monica, welcome to Off Mic.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, Monica, yesterday Gary, Indiana established one of these baby boxes. Can you tell me a little bit of the history? How did you get involved with this movement?
Well, the Safe Haven Law has been around for the last 20 years, where a woman can walk into any fire station, hospital, or police station and basically hand her child that she doesn't want or can't care for 30 days or less. The child has to be 30 days or less, and then she can walk away, no questions asked, and it's completely legal in our country. And so I was actually in Cape Town, South Africa, when I seen a baby safe in the side of a church in the wall, and I was so intrigued by that. I came back to the United States, and I couldn't get that vision out of my mind, and I started to research the Safe Haven Law and how many babies were still being abandoned, even with a law on the books allowing women to walk into these facilities. And so we're still finding a baby every 3 days in our country dead in trash cans or dumpsters or just abandoned alongside the road. And I thought, what can we do to allow this mom to keep her child safe, but also get 100% anonymity so that she doesn't have to look anyone in the eye and explain why she feels she has to do this? And so back in 2015, the very first prototype was built. And in 2016, the very first baby safe in America was placed in Woodburn, Indiana. And the second baby safes are in Africa. But the second baby box was placed in Cold Springs Fire Department, which is right outside Michigan City. And their baby box has had two babies since we launched in their fire station in April of 2016.
And these baby boxes, this is exactly where somebody could actually, I mean, is it physically where you just like pull out the box itself from the door or from the wall, put the baby in and push it inside and that'd be it?
Yeah, that's pretty much the concept. I mean, they are alarm activated. So even though the mom does not hear any alarms going off, the box actually calls 911 on its own. And so 911 is notified that there's a baby in the box, and the babies are the average time for our babies. And we've had 10 babies in the last 2 years in Indiana in our boxes. The average time for a baby to be retrieved from those boxes is right about 2 minutes. So it's very quick. The alarms that are set off, and mom doesn't have to do anything but open the door on the outside of the building, place her child inside, shut the door, and walk away.
Has there ever been an instance where perhaps the parent, either the mom or some, I'm not even sure if there are some fathers are involved in this, maybe sort of changed their mind and come forward and say, hey, I'm the one that pushed the baby in the box and I want it back?
We actually have. We've had one out of the 10 that we've had in our boxes. We've had one baby that the mom did come back and want to do a parenting plan for. And, you know, we actually help these moms because we're not just about saving babies in boxes. We're about saving moms as well. And so we actually hired this mother, an attorney, to help her get her child back. And we put her in counseling as well, because there's a reason she's at that box. You know, it's not to have coffee with the fire department. You know, she's in a crisis that you and I may never understand. And we want to make sure that crisis is gone before we help her get her child back. And so through that the counseling, the crisis counseling that she was getting, she actually decided to do an open adoption for that child. So we actually helped her take custody of that child from the Department of Child Services. And then basically in the next minute, after receiving that child, she handed that child to a set of adoptive parents. And now she has an open adoption with that child. And that's a beautiful story when you really think about it, because adoption is such a better option than the safe haven law, because a mom who places her child in one of our boxes or walks into a fire station and hands the child to a person, they don't ever see that child again. You know, the child will go on to be adopted, but the child will never have any information from that parent. And so an open adoption allows that parent to still be a part of that child's life. And I think that's very important for an adoptee like myself. I was abandoned as an infant. That's why I started this organization. And for kids like me, you know, it's important for us to know our heritage. And so the baby box is literally a last resort option for these moms if they can't do an open adoption, or they can't do a parenting plan, or they can't, you know, walk into a fire station and hand that child to a person. The baby box is a last resort option for them.
And you say there have been 10 babies in the past 2 years in Indiana that have been placed in these baby boxes?
Yes, we've had 10 babies in our boxes, and then we've had 86 babies surrendered by doing what we call a handoff. And the handoff is where a woman, this is part of the program, is trying to get this mom to walk into a hospital or a fire station, hand the child to a person, and also receive medical care if she wishes to. And we've had 86 women do that, where they walked into fire stations or hospitals and handed their child to them under the safe haven law and either received medical care or refused medical care. So we're almost at 100 babies through our program just in the last 2 years.
You know, obviously we don't know too much about the mothers who put these babies in the boxes. Of information that we do know, are these usually women who are younger in age, unemployed? Do we know anything about the background of some of these mothers?
We do have mothers that contact us for assistance afterwards or before they place in our boxes. So we do have a relationship with a lot of these moms. And, you know, some of them are very young. Some of them are in their 30s with children at home. I can tell you that out of the 10 babies that have been placed in our boxes, only one of those babies had drugs in their system. So these babies that are placed in our boxes, you know, out of the 10, we've only had one baby that had drugs in their system. And that speaks volumes about the moms who utilize these boxes, because it's not that they don't love their child. You know, they absolutely love their child. They're keeping them safe. And they're just kind of in a crisis that you and I may never understand. But it's not about, you know, not loving their child, because they absolutely do. They're keeping their child safe while surrendering.
Let me ask you this. If this story or this radio program gets to a young mother who's deciding whether to give up their child because of whatever they're going through, what information at the minimum can they provide those who may be receiving the child in terms of maybe blood type or age or weight? What other information could be useful to those who are now going to have to take care of this child, just basic information?
You know, any information that a mother wants to give is always useful. But there are moms that don't want to give any information, and that's okay. You know, we've had adoption on the books for thousands, I don't want to say thousands, hundreds of years, where, you know, people were raising other people's kids and didn't know anything about the biological families. And so this is just continuing that. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, and myself, I my birth mom was 17 years old and abandoned me 2 hours after I was born. And, you know, for me growing up, I was my parents' child, you know, that adopted me. That was my mom and dad. That was, you know, this was my world, my life. And for these kids that are growing up that have been placed in these boxes or surrendered under the safe haven law, they're very much loved and very much wanted. And, you know, it's all up to the parents who adopt these kids to make sure that they understand how special they really are. And for those who choose to surrender under the safe haven law, you can give as much information or you can give as little as you'd like, you know. But the one thing that we do recommend is you keep your child safe, follow the law, and then walk away, because then the police will never look for you. You're doing it legally, and your child's life is saved, and your life will go on.
How do you feel about this newest baby box in Northwest Indiana at a fire station in Gary, Indiana?
You know, I think for Gary, you know, we've been working with Gary for a long time to get a box up there, and I'm super excited to have one in that area. You know, the northwest part of the state has always been the number one place for babies being placed in our boxes. And so Gary, you know, with it being, you know, up in that corridor of the Chicago area, I don't think it's a matter of if this box gets used. I think it's a matter of when this box gets used. And I think women in that community are going to be utilizing this resource that was not available prior to yesterday.
Well, Monica Kelsey with Safe Haven Baby Boxes, thank you so much for joining us here today on Off Mic.
Hey, thank you guys for having me. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. And we'll be back with more Off Mic.
Yes, the record of the year is, she said, beat it, Michael Jackson.
Been nominated for album of the year is Prince of the Revolution. And the Grammy goes to Billie Eilish.
Oh my God, so many other songs deserve this. I'm sorry.
Ever met a real nigga rock star? This ain't no guitar.
As long as
I just don't know.
I got the radar right already. Lock this place so study. Everyone tells each other all kinds of.
I've been sleeping all my dreams.
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. That, of course, were highlights from the Grammy Awards, way back from Michael Jackson and Prince to today's artist. The nominations for the 2021 Grammy Awards were announced earlier this week. They featured many familiar artists like Billie Eilish, Taylor Swift, Harry Styles, Dua Lipa, BTS, and many others, including Gary, Indiana's own Freddie Gibbs for Best Rap Song. But some artists like Halsey and The Weeknd got snubbed despite having big records out this year. And here to talk to me about the nomination process for the Grammy Awards is Lakeshore Public Media's own Larry Breckner. Hey, Larry, how are you?
Oh, I'm glad to be here, Michael. Thank you so much for having me.
I think this is your first time on Off Mic.
Yes, it is, and which I listen to all the time, even though it runs opposite my show on WVLP, but that's okay.
That's great. So Larry Breckner sits on the board for Lakeshore Public Radio, but he's also a voting member of the Grammy Awards. He's been a Larry, how long have you been a voting member for the Grammy Awards?
It happened back in the 1980s. I was watching the 23rd Grammy Awards, and that's when Christopher Cross won for Sailing, 6 Grammy Awards. And my background was I had a small recording studio, a little 4-track studio, and I've done mostly demo recordings, but one of the demo recordings that I had done was for someone called Ron Martinez and Time. And then he actually commercially released that. And there was a couple others I did too, but I didn't really wasn't really aware of that. So after watching the 23rd Grammy Awards, I contacted the Los Angeles office and said, hey, what is it required to be a voting member for the Academy? And they said, well, you have to be creatively involved in one side of an album or six singles. I said, well, send me an application. Got the application. $50 later, I was a voting member for the Academy because I was an engineer on a released recording, and actually a couple of them I'd listed. But and so how that matriculated, I decided, you know, it might be kind of fun to go to the Grammy Awards. It was only $50, by the way, to join back then. So I went to the 24th Grammys, which was in February. And actually took someone actually took someone you know who eventually I endorsed to get in the Grammys, Greg Ladd, and we went together.
That's
and
right.
That first year we sat row 13, not dead center, but we were definitely in celeb section. Here's little me with a 4-track studio from the Chicago chapter of the Grammys, and it was really something. It was at the Shrine Auditorium. Of course, we didn't have a limo, but we'd drive up park and then come on the red carpet, and it's really an experience. And one of the experiences I liked about it is you're watching a live concert-y type show, and you're watching a live television show. And it's amazing. John Denver was the host that year. But just watching how and of course, you know, from my theater background, I was just amazed how they change over things. And the funny part was and during commercials, how everyone was up, seemed like they're out of their seats, and then they would scramble back as they came back from commercials. So, and the other part of that is we went to the party afterwards, which was included. By the way, it only cost $50 for the ticket to go to that and the party. The party was at the Biltmore. It was a beautiful, they have all five ballrooms. We actually were staying at the Biltmore. And in the Mayor Ricci band in the hallway, and you just ran into everyone that was popular and from that time. And quickly, one of the people I was most impressed with that I met was Pierre Cossette, who is the executive producer of the show. We spent about 15 minutes talking about how you put on a show, how you do a live concert and a television show.
Yeah, and before we get any further, we did mention Greg Ladd. Greg Ladd was actually one of my early mentors. He was a professor at Calumet College of St. Joseph's. Greg was just an invaluable influence on my life, and the late Greg Ladd, and passed away maybe about 10, 15 years ago now. But yeah, Greg was also a voting member of the Grammy Awards. And in fact, I used to remember him walking around with his this great-looking leather Grammy Award jacket on with the Grammy logo. And I'm like, how are you a voting member of the Grammy Awards? So I was always in awe in that. So now that, you know, there's been so many nominees this year. I mean, there's a big list. Harry Styles, Taylor Swift, Justin Bieber, Lady Gaga. I mean, and then even locally for Best Rap Album, Freddie Gibbs of Gary, Indiana, got his first nomination, is up there with some big names and everything. Some of this music, do you actually listen to, and did you vote in this last nomination process?
Yes, I did. I should tell you how it works. The process really quickly is artists, individuals, record companies, what they still exist them, they go into what's called the entry phase during the eligibility period, which is September 1st to the following August 31st. So then they enter that in. The first phase of voting is that they put out everyone that's eligible. They have people who screen it. And then they put everyone that's in that category. So like, let's say it's best pop solo performance. There's a whole list. There might be 140, 200 people in there. The top vote getters then become the nominees. And that's the next phase of voting. Then the nominees are voted for. It used to be that there was only five nominees. They've now expanded it to usually from 7 to 10 nominees in a category. It's just the way music has. And so that's how it is. So, yes, you now listen. The old days, how we listened, is they had a thing called the Grammy Awards Guide where you would order, in that day, LPs or single, mostly LPs to listen to, and you voted that way. And they were only like $2 an album. It was a great way to build a record collection, by the way. Later on, of course, CDs. But now you go online, you log in to your member porthole for a voting member, and then you can listen to entire albums, different selections, singles, tracks, or anything like that. And the honest way to do that is you should listen to everything in a category in which you're going to vote. And, of course, you don't get to vote in every category. You can vote in every category. The top four, Record of the Year, Album of the Year, Song of the Year, and Best New Artist. That's called general. Everyone gets to vote in those categories. But then you have like 30 fields, pop, dance electric, contemporary, rock, reggae, and a whole different one. And within those fields, there may be multiple ones or not. And so you have to select how many of those you get to vote. And there's like 84 of those individual categories. So it's a lot of work to actually do a right job. And so I don't always vote in everything, but everything I vote for, I've listened to and made a decision about. So
every year, there's always like somebody who feels that they got snubbed. You got Halsey, who didn't get a nomination. The Weeknd didn't get a nomination. So when a big performer like someone like, say, The Weeknd or Halsey, just they sort of quote unquote get snubbed for a nomination, how does the Academy answer for something like this? Because Weeknd just been lighting it up over the past year.
Well, you know, it's, remember, like the Oscars, it's an industry award, unlike a you know, popularity thing like the American Music Awards or People's Choice type awards. And sometimes I think there's a lag in the industry maybe to catch up. I know back when I joined, there was only 5,000 members, voting members for the Academy, and they were tended to be older, more traditional music. It was a lot, you know, yeah, there was rock music and things like that, but a lot of those people were not voting members. So for a few years there, the music was a, you know, kind of older style and didn't get recognized. That's changed. The Academy is now has, I think, 21,000 members, of which, I guess, currently, and I checked this for my, to be accurate, there's right now for this season 12,000 actual eligible voting members, some of which who've left their membership lapsed, but they still keep them on as members. There are also associate members who are non-voting members who haven't met the requirements, but they support the thing. But yeah, I know what you mean. And then, you know, I know we talked about before the interview about the Latin Grammys, and I looked back up. The year I went on the 24th, there was only one Latin category. It was just like Latin music. Because that category has become so important, they started expanding within the Grammys, and they still have categories in the regular Grammys. They broke out and to address that, have a separate, but not called separate but equal, Latin Grammy, which is actually a whole thing unto itself. And it, the categories are much more expanded. And I think that was really an interesting way to address that. It was how they carried that on and everything like that. So that way they were able to expand the number of awards they give out.
You know, but even with that, people will say things like, you know, the Latin Grammys are considered, in some people's estimation, because it's separated out, because it had, they have, you know, Latin Grammys are their own thing, their own ceremony, their own televised ceremony, that it feels like it's being segregated. But on the flip side of that, how would you, I mean, do you see it as a less than Grammy? And do you vote on the Latin Grammys?
No, I don't, because I don't listen. You know, those, that's music I don't necessarily listen to. But I think that was a smart move by the Academy. They are looking at, this category was getting so big to contain it within the Grammy Awards. It's not a less than award. It's a happening area. In fact, they have a separate televised ceremony on CBS from the Grammy Awards. I mean, it's really marketed. And you got to remember, the Grammy Awards are not just awards. I mean, they have their Music Cares, which supports training. They are an advocacy organization. They have a Grammy Museum now. And so they are doing other things out there. They're especially supporting copyright and the advocacy, because that's really an issue that is important, because the way music is produced now is completely different than it was in the 80s and 90s, where you put a hard thing out. So to be a member now, you don't necessarily have to put out a CD, but you do have to have a commercial release, even if it's online. Now, you can't just post it to your website and call it release. It has to go to a commercial thing, and there has to be a commercial element, like a saleable element to it. So the Grammys have changed, and they're trying to adapt to the changes of the industry. No, but back to the Latin Grammys, I think that was tremendous. That was very smart on them to, they now could expand the different nuances within that category.
You know, I have a little bit of an understanding of how the nomination works and votes and the controversy that can come with it. Every award season, when it comes to movies, there's always a movie that some people will say got snubbed or should have got more nominations or a nomination. I'm a voting member of the SAG-AFTRA Awards, the Screen Actor Guild Awards. And even there, you'll hear about a movie that maybe was snubbed. But I always challenge people to ask themselves, okay, of the categories you think so-and-so should have gotten a nomination or a film or a performer, who in that list should be taken out? Because it really, again, it is all subjective. It is all, I mean, look, everybody wants to be recognized for their achievements and awards. I think some of the pop stars are being awarded by the money they get for making a blockbuster album. You don't really need a Grammy to solidify, but at the same time, I understand it. What do you say to people? I mean, you got to be in conversation with some people, especially young people, who right away they turn to the term snub and or that really lightning rod term, racism.
Well, I don't so about racism, but I would say that it's an industry award, and sometimes how the industry works and where it's centered. If you actually go out during Grammy season or Oscar season, for that matter, in Los Angeles, record companies and people buy billboards and there's promotions. We don't see that so much here in our market in the Chicago DMA. But in New York and the big areas like that, you'll see real promotion and money being spent. So that has a lot to influence with it. Money for the Oscar, that whole thing, but same thing with the Grammys. And you get things. A group I'm involved with is on Facebook. It's called the FYC Group. It's a four-year consideration. And what they do, and there's several of these, but they have one each year, it's more indie artists. And I've now tried to explore some of these people. I've actually become friends with many of them. Wouter Kellerman, who's a Grammy Award winner, flautist, and several others. Actually, some of them I've had on my radio show. But I try to listen to their music and try to get them in the category, which is a tough thing, tough slog, because you're now dealing with, like you said, artists that have multiple millions of dollars to promote their work. And it's so tough for a little guy. But then you have someone like Billie Eilish, who comes through from nowhere and walked away with, I think almost four Grammys last
year. Oh, my God, and she is huge. She is huge. Everybody loves her. So let me ask you this. When you're sitting down and you're thinking about who to nominate, you got these categories, in your mind, does it matter to you how many, like if a song charted number one or how many units sold? Do you not pay attention to that and just say, hey, look, I'm going what I'm listening to. If it sold 5 million records, great. If it was like Thriller or if it was from some group or rapper or something that a lot of people may not have paid attention to, but it sounds great.
I vote for what I like. The amount of sales, the stardom factor doesn't affect me anymore. I now try to almost look for artists in these categories that may be overlooked and try to at least vote for them to get them to a nomination at least. And I'm happy because the nomination is a big deal in and of itself. I mean, now you're part of that year being nominated in a category for a Grammy Award. So I spend a lot of time doing that. It takes hours and everything like that. More in that first phase. In the second phase, in which we have yet to vote on because the nominations have just come out, a lot of the music that I'll see for nominees are, I'll vote for. But I definitely take a long listen to it. The popularity of them, I try to put blinders on about that. Say, I'm looking for the person that I really think their music deserves an award. And that's what the Grammys actually tell you to do. And they're very strict about, not accepting money or anything like that for your vote. And I take that very seriously. I think ethics are a major part of being a voting member.
But do you think maybe, like, for example, I know she's big and she is popular and she's very talented. Someone like a Taylor Swift, she's already won 10 Grammys. Do you think sometimes maybe judges might sway to maybe the safe choice in a category? Or, I mean, I'm not saying she doesn't deserve it, but 10 Grammys is a lot for somebody her age already.
Well, and I've seen this with even other award show like Oscars. There's a certain thing that you might be tired of the fact that that person has won that many, and you look to something else. And again, since there's no really judges involved, it's the entire Academy. But there could be a pushback saying, okay, Taylor's won 10. Yeah, I maybe like her current song, but let's give someone else a chance. I do think there's a little bit of that sometimes goes on. Like I said, that's why now I try to listen to some of these indie artists a little bit more to really give them a chance to do that. Because the big people are probably always going to be in the nomination category because the money they bring to it and everything. So let's give someone else a chance. And the Grammy is the industry award. No matter, all these countries have their own awards. Wouter Kellerman told me that. He says, when I was nominated for a Grammy and I actually won it, he says, that's the award.
That's the award you want, not the American Music Award. Right. And yeah, American Music Award, I people probably don't know the history. Probably just Dick Clark started right. it, I think, as a way to kind of compete against the Grammys.
Exactly.
But the Grammy, when people talk about this racism factor, I'm like, well, look, well, one year it's racist, but if it's a racist award, why would you want it in the first place? Then why would you the person you want to get it even submit their name for consideration if you're totally against the award? I'm not saying there's not racism involved in it. I mean, it seems like it's everywhere in our society, but maybe some people gravitate to it a little bit too quick sometimes.
I agree with you. And actually, if you look at the music that's embraced by the Grammys now, it's kind of off my chart a little bit. You know, I'm kind of still a little older style music. I know the category I love voting is the best traditional pop, which are, you know, a lot more older artists or people that are much more traditional in terms of the pop music. But I always vote in like the musical theater album category and things like that. But I've been now listening to the folk, not the folk, but the Americana factor and world music, because that's where I'm starting to meet people in. So.
Well, you know, you mentioned the best traditional pop vocal album, and I just had that on my page. You got Blue Umbrella, True Love by Harry Connick Jr. Well, Blue Umbrella by Burt Bacharach and right. Daniel Tashian. True Love, A Celebration of Cole Porter by Harry Connick Jr. American Standard by James Taylor, the great James Taylor. Unfollow the Rules by Rufus Wainwright. And Judy by Renee Zellweger. So you got some big names in there. And, you know, so, and I'm sure you're big on the best dance recording.
Well, you know, back in my era, in my living era, they used to have a separate category called disco. And it lasted only for a few years, and then that category kind of faded away. Yeah, I haven't listened to I don't think dance was in my my voting thing. And you're restricted in what you can vote on. You can choose everything to vote on, but you know the idea is that you, let's say there's so many fields you can vote in, you have to be very selective about what you vote in. So it's a process to actually think about that.
Again, how many voting members are there, eligible voters for the
currently
Grammy
this
Academy?
Year there are 12,000. There are 21,000 in the Academy, and some of them they didn't get their. Some of them are voting members, but they didn't get their fee in, so they can't vote for this season. And then there's a bunch of... So there's a total number of 21,000 members in the Academy, some of which are associate members, non-voting, and some of which... But I checked that out before we did the interview, and there's actually currently this year 12,000 who are eligible to vote.
All right, Larry Bruckner, a voting member of the Grammy Awards. It's going to be... later in January. Do you still watch the Grammy Awards?
Yes, I do. Sometimes it's hard. sometimes I'm sitting there going, oh my gosh, because I'm also, from my theater background, very sure. critical of production values. But yeah, it's January 31st this year. It's always a dance to find out when they're going to do it, because they have to miss Super Bowl weekend and other awards things, so it's a tough thing.
Well, next time you get tickets, I mean, you know, maybe we can go together or whatever.
That's
and I'll pay for the limo.
Okay. Well, the ticket now, just to go to the Grammys as a member, is $250. And to go to the party is another $250. That when I was, it was $50.
Well, even $250, I'd pay that now.
Well, good for you.
I thought you were going to say $2,500 or $5,000.
But then you end up now in the nosebleed seats. The best seats I ever had was that first year I went in the 24th. After that, I always, no matter what, even member tickets, I was like sitting the first row of the balcony or something like that. So,
all right, Larry Bruckner, voting member again with the Grammy Awards and also a board member for Lakeshore Public Media. Larry, thank you for joining us here on Off Mic.
I really appreciate it, Mike. Thank you so much.
And we'll be back with more Off Mic.
Yeah.
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lake Shore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. We were just talking about the Grammys and the nominees, and one of the nominees is Freddie Gibbs of Gary, Indiana. His Alfredo album is nominated in the Best Rap Album category. So who is Freddie Gibbs, and why is his music getting such acclaim? Joining me to talk about Gibbs is Gabe Mendoza, hip-hop guru from Vocalo, WBEZ's sister station. Hey, Gabe, welcome to Off Mic.
Thanks, Mike. I appreciate you joining me.
No problem. Hey, listen. I know you've been kind of raving about Freddie Gibbs for a few years now. You've been talking about him. How does someone like a Freddie Gibbs out of Gary get so much acclaim and attention now?
Freddie, I came to know Freddie when I was doing a college radio show about 10, 11 years ago, and that's right when about his buzz during what we referred to as the blog era. And so that was when mixtapes and, you know, street singles were being released through blog media. And that's how I became familiar with them, through the actual Fake Short Drive, which is a hugely popular hip-hop website here in Chicago and across the country, to be honest. And I came to know him from a feature that he did on that Fake Short mixtape, and I just became enamored with him and his voice, his delivery, his specialty to discussing street elements in a very quizzical and wizardry way that's also kind of has this dark humor about it. And so he's been on my radar for a long time. And he's had multiple record label deals that fell through, one with Interscope and one with Corporate Thugs Entertainment with Young Jeezy down south. And both of those fell through. And then when he found his independence, that's when he really started to hit his stride creatively and commercially as well.
Right away you think of somebody from Indiana, but does he get any more street cred points because he's from Gary, Indiana?
I think that his upbringing or his story is probably not that different than what we often hear with a lot of records that deal with street elements, especially here in Chicago with the drill sound. But I think it's the way that his style that's enamored and sort of take us into a place of a space that we're fascinated with, but also there's a dangerous element. So I don't think that Gary, Indiana necessarily is a selling point, but I just think the way that he's able to explore his upbringing and tell those stories is what captivates the audience.
You know, he's going up against four other nominees in that Best Rap Album category for the Grammy Awards. In some websites and some other sort of blogs and video blogs that I've been looking at, they say that this Alfredo album is a cut above the rest out of all those other nominees. That is just an incredible album. And what makes this album special?
So he partnered again with the California-based producer The Alchemist, who is a living icon in hip-hop music. So this is their second effort together. They did an album back in 2018 titled Fetty. And so this is their second effort together. And I think that what this album does is that the sound is very melodramatic. It's very haunting. It just has again, it kind of fits into what Freddie Gibbs is used to, but it's also a different sound. And Freddie has always, in my opinion, stood out when he's worked with one producer, and he's done that multiple times with Madlib, another West Coast producer, who also has a very unorthodox style of production that you wouldn't think that would cater to a harder edge Freddie Gibbs. And they also struck out really well with the Bandana last year, and a few years before that, Pinata. So when he works with one producer, like with The Alchemist, it just seems like that always brings out the best in him. And I think that it's a shining moment for the Grammys to acknowledge these type of records that don't necessarily get the huge commercial play, but all have an impact on music and the hip-hop community.
Yeah, I'm sure Freddie Gibbs is pretty popular in rap circles and even music circles, but you think he's ready? What do you think his odds are at winning the Grammy Award on that night?
Not good. I think that this year is just a truly phenomenal year for what we're seeing with the options to choose from, because they're just so diverse from what we normally see and some of those pop hip-hop acts that usually security slots. And so I think that him going against Nas, who with the King's Disease, Nas has been around for 25 years and has not won a Grammy, which is just an amazing footnote in his career. And I think that this is his Denzel Washington Training Day moment, where it's not his best record, but I think it's just time for the committee over at the Grammys to give him his due. So I don't expect Freddie to win, but I think that it's still a huge achievement that he's acknowledged, and I think that there's a lot to be said about that.
All right, Gabe Mendoza is the hip-hop expert over there at Vocalo, WBEZ's sister station. Gabe, thank you so much for taking some time for joining us here on Off Mic.
Thank you.
And that is all the time we have for today's show. You can catch this show as a podcast by going to lakeshorepublicradio.com. For me, Michael Puente, and everyone here at Lakeshore Public Radio, have a great weekend.